The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Sarah Crown.
Mars ruled the sky. It was half illuminated, the shadowed hemisphere serving only to emphasize that this was a three-dimensional thing, a sphere bulging out towards her. With no air between her and the atmosphere of Mars, and very little air in the atmosphere to begin with, the ground features appeared preternaturally sharp, defined with a mapmaker's fastidiousness. The lit hemisphere was a warm salmon hue, tinged here and there with dusty swathes of ochre and burnt sienna. White snow frosted the visible pole, cutting across the face the claw marks of some staggering canyon system gouged deep into the flesh of the world. Valles Marineris, Sunday thought. She knew that much, at least. And that fracture zone, where the canyons dissolved into a quilt of shattered intricacy, was the Noctis Labyrinthus, the Maze of Night. The three volcanoes beyond the maze, Ascraeus Mons, Pavonis Mons, Arzia Mons.
Alistair Reynolds there, reading from his book Blue Remembered Earth. We'll be hearing more from Alistair later in the programme. For our first books podcast of 2012, it seems appropriate that we look to the future. Science fiction has never been bigger. Back in October, Terry Pratchett's latest novel, Snuff, became the fastest-selling adult hardback novel by a British novelist since records began, and publishers are falling over themselves to sign the next big name in the genre. The hotly contested acquisition of Lauren Bucus's latest novel, The Shining Girls, was won by HarperCollins late last year for a six-figure sum. And why? Because her last novel, Zoo City, won the 2011 Arthur C. Clarke Award. Set in a reimagined Johannesburg, Zoo City is a hard-boiled thriller about crime, magic, the music industry, refugees and redemption. Damien Walter spoke to Lauren in her Cape Town home via the wonder of Skype and began by asking her where she thought SF stood in 2012 and where she herself fits into it.
I find that a very hard, difficult question to answer because science fiction is such a broad church. You know, I mean, a lot of people have said that Zoo City is actually an urban fantasy novel. And personally, I kind of chafe at labels. I don't like things being neatly catalogued and filed into genus and subspecies. I think that's also because I read widely, and there's so many books that I read that are imaginative and exciting and speculative and really kind of play with ideas. So I'd like to invent a whole new genre, which would be imaginative fiction, because I find we fall into kind of genre wars of literature versus science fiction. And I don't think it's a real war. I think it's very loud voices on either side. And unfortunately, some of those voices are quite influential and they might, you know, rule out China Mirabal from the Booker, for example. But I do think we all just actually need to be more open-minded and stop this insane idea of classifying everything down to kind of subspecies.
Well, there's nothing that a science fiction fandom likes to do more than categorize works of fiction. Almost every novel has its own genre these days, I think.
Completely. Well, maybe that's not a bad idea, is that everything gets its own genre and reinvents itself completely all the time. I do think there's snobbery from both sides, and that science fiction fans need to read more lit, and lit fans need to read more science fiction, and just shut up and try something new.
Well, it's a very strange divide that we've arrived at between these different genres of literature, when especially they all really relate back to the real world that we're living in, however fantastic they are. So you said in your acceptance speech for the Clarke Awards that South Africa had been an incredible place to write about. Could you tell us more about why and how South Africa's worked as a setting for your novels?
I think South Africa is very much kind of a microcosm for the rest of the world in terms of big issues. You know, we're very much first world and third world intersecting right on top of each other, just like China Mirabal's The City and the City, actually. And it's a very, very interesting and exciting space, and often quite a depressing space. I think things are very real and immediate here, unless you kind of fence yourself off in your exclusive gated suburb. But there's a real energy and a vibrancy, and I think the way we use technology in South Africa is very different. It feels very kind of emerging and on the edge of things.
You've got a strong background in journalism and reporting as well, and there seems in Zoo City to be a strong element of reportage and reporting back on South Africa in a way. Do you feel a kind of responsibility to write about the country, and has your journalistic background influenced that?
Definitely. I mean, I write about the things which make me angry, but not, I hope, in a preachy way. I hope it just kind of becomes elements in the story. I do feel like an ambassador for South Africa, and I do feel like a translator as well. And there's some very strange things in Zoo City, which I took from the news verbatim. 90% of the Johannesburg depicted in Zoo City is actually the real Johannesburg, basically bar the magical animals. So, yeah, journalism has been a huge influence. I did a big research trip there into Hillbrow and around, and seeing social issues and seeing the divide, seeing 3,000 refugees packed into kind of a rundown church in the middle of the city center because that's the only recourse that they have, which didn't actually make it into the book because it was so devastating. You know, that's really stuff which has influenced me. Those are stories that I wanted to tell, and to tell them in a very human and interesting and storytelling kind of way. I think also people have an idea of Africa as Lord of War or Hotel Rwanda or, you know, very, very desperately rural and child soldiers. And I wanted to show a different side of South Africa and Africa in general.
Well, South Africa seems to be inspiring lots of great fiction, obviously, but obviously lots of great science fiction, writers including Andrew Salomon and S.L. Gray. Why do you think that is in particular?
I think the market has finally opened up. For a long time, the South African publishing industry was very focused on kind of more important books and less entertainment. And genre has really exploded. South African crime writing is kind of almost rivaling Scandinavian. And genre writing, science fiction writing, and horror writing is starting to emerge now. The stuff S.L. Gray is doing with horror is terrifying. And what I love about what S.L. Gray does is because it's a collaboration between two authors, S.L. Gray does a lot of really interesting social issues, and there's a lot of kind of sly social commentary and digs at what's happening in the world right now, and I really like that. It's not just a horror, it also has that social element. There's also Lily Hearn, who writes YA zombie apocalypse novels. There's a new writer called Charlie Human, who I kind of helped mentor through the UCT Masters in Creative Writing program, and he's got a wonderful just kind of crazy novel about zombie strippers and magic unleashed in Cape Town and Mecca, and it's just wonderful and mad, and I'm hoping that'll be coming out probably sometime in 2013. It's being shopped around at the moment. So there are exciting new voices, and I think the Arthur C. Clarke Award obviously meant a lot to me, but I think it's meant even more to South Africa. It's been a really, really big deal here, and a lot of people have said to me that how inspiring it was that I made it seem possible. And that Zoo City's success and the success of something like District 9 has just really showed people that there is an interest in South African stories and stories which are not apartheid stories or, you know, whatever we typically think of South African stories being, further afield than J.M. Coetzee.
Which is very good to hear, science fiction growing in South Africa. And it also seems to be growing around the world at the moment. And one of the places you can really spot that is on the internet, where science fiction has always been an early adopter of technology. Science fiction fans were some of the first to make websites, and now we're increasingly using social media, and there's a large science fiction community on Twitter. I know you've actually used Twitter to an extent to crowdsource some of the research for your novels. Was that information that ended up going into Zoo City?
Oh, definitely. I found a lot of great information on Twitter from real people that I would never have been able to Google. You know, I grew up in Johannesburg and I went on a research trip there, which was great. But there was some information I needed to find out, like, if you were going to dump a body in Johannesburg, where would you dump it? And apparently the best place to dump a body is in Troyville, according to my Twitter followers, which is a little bit creepy, but also really cool, amazing detail that you could only get from people who actually live there and really know the city very well.
What I'd like to look at quickly is your next book that's upcoming from HarperCollins, The Shining Girls, which has already had a lot of publicity and people are already talking about it very excitedly. How did that come to be placed with HarperCollins? Was there a bidding war for it?
There was a big auction for it. It was all quite stunning and bizarre. you know, normally as an author, you're the one standing outside in the cold and the rain on the curb, battering at the publisher's door saying, please let me in. If you just let me in, I could show you this wonderful manuscript. And this time around, I had editors phoning me and telling me how much they loved the book. And yeah, it was such a strange reversal of fortune. It was a very wonderful place to be. It was like being on an amazing dating show with all these just incredible candidates.
Do you think that signing with HarperCollins, as you have, and another of other high-profile science fiction titles coming out through mainstream imprints and publishers in the year to come, do you think this is a sign that sci-fi is crossing into the mainstream?
I think science fiction has always been crossing into the mainstream. You know, if you look at Cormac McCarthy's The Road, or Margaret Atwood, or William Gibson, Jennifer Egan, Visit from the Goon Squad, was basically science fiction, and that won the Pulitzer. If you look at geek culture in cinema and TV, there's definitely a big push towards science fiction, and maybe books are following pace. But maybe it's also always been there, and now people are just kind of more open about it or talking about it more.
Lauren's next book, The Shining Girls, is out next year. Now, there are few people better qualified to measure the state of SF than the man who helped create it. Michael Moorcock became editor of New Worlds magazine in the early 1960s, and together with novelists such as J.G. Ballard and Brian Aldiss, used it to transform science fiction, moving the genre away from ray guns and spaceships towards psychology, the mass media, and altered states of consciousness. Michael Moorcock spoke to Claire Armitstead from his home in Texas and began by telling her how he felt about contemporary science fiction.
My attitude these days is, you know, as of an old fogey, completely disappointed with it for failing in its potential. The science fiction that we liked, you know, when we were doing New Worlds, which was, you know, which we'd read in the 50s, was primarily either Ray Bradbury, you know, who was essentially a stylist and a fantasist, or Pohl and Kornbluth, who did The Space Merchants, which was, you know, essentially an If This Goes On sort of novel, social science fiction, I suppose you could call it, which essentially predicted much of what is already happening. I mean, it was pretty accurate in its prediction. Most of the social fiction that was done in the 50s that predicted changes in society rather than changes in technology, although, of course, the two tended to go together. And to me, that kind of science fiction is still very, very interesting and valid and worthwhile. And I don't see very much of it about. There's, on one hand, there's sort of steampunk, which is essentially fantasy. And on the other hand, there's sort of space fiction, the sort of stuff that Ian, oh God, what's Ian's name?
Ian Banks. You know,
Ian Banks, that Ian writes, which is sort of far future, you know, intergalactic stuff, you know, which is interesting, I'm sure. I'm not saying it lacks any substance, but to me, it's not of any great interest. You know, the science fiction that's been most successful in predicting things, in fact, has been the science fiction that hasn't had very much science in it.
Can I take you right back there now, back to you, to New Worlds, which you've mentioned, but we haven't explained to anybody who's too young to know about it. And this was a hugely influential magazine, which is, it's like the foundational text, isn't it, of modern science fiction. Who did it involve? It involved you and Brian Aldiss and J.G. Ballard, to name only three of you.
Well, yeah, I suppose we were the three
wise
best
men,
known people doing it. And there wasn't very much science, again, in the stuff that was in New Worlds. The thing that I think people don't quite get is that we weren't really interested in to improve the genre. We were really not interested in the genre as such. We were interested in what we could, you know, make of the genre.
What was it that you particularly brought to it when you took it over?
I think partly it was youth. I was 10 years younger than Ballard, for instance, 15 years younger than Brian. I was sort of part of the generation that was producing, you know, magazines like Oz and IT, and of course I also contributed to those magazines, and was part of that whole group. It was a lot easier, if you like, for me to encourage writers to address issues of the day rather than avoid issues of the day. I think, you know, most genre fiction, I mean any genre fiction, is escapist almost by definition. people want something that they want what they expect to get, as it were, and very disappointed if they don't get it. So we had a lot of science fiction readers who felt we'd betrayed science fiction. We perhaps had a broader set of enthusiasms than most science fiction people had had before that.
So what do you think the legacy of New Worlds was?
I don't know, really. I mean, a large amount of debt for me. I think it did shake things up. It allowed people, I think, to be in some ways smarter than they'd been allowed to be and to take more chances than they'd been allowed to do in those magazines. And any legacy is probably, I suppose, that we just freed things up, that we allowed writers to write whatever they liked and to publish it, the publishing, of course, being the important thing, because we gave people a chance to publish where they would never have been able to publish before, either in the literary magazines or the commercial magazines.
Now, moving on to your own work, I've got a couple of questions from our Twitter followers. One from at Ganglesprocket, who says, what's the quickest book you've ever written and is it still in print? Now, I would point out to people who don't know your work that you are prodigious, aren't you? You're one of the quickest writers probably ever.
I used to be, yeah. I asked my publisher whether I still am.
So what is the quickest book you've ever written and is it still in print?
I wrote one in 2 days. I used to write them in 3 days regularly. I mean, so there were a whole lot of books that were written in 3 days. All of the books in the Hawkmoon series, which is still in print, were written in 3 days each. You could make much more money doing journalism than you could writing fiction. And so I only had about 3 days in which I could write the books and make about the same amount of money that I would make if I was writing, a feature of some kind. It's hard to say which book is the quickest, but I think probably there's one that isn't in print, which was essentially a rewrite, and it came out under somebody else's name, and it was called the LSD dossier.
And the next question, now this is a big one, so I'm going to set you a challenge to answer it in 30 seconds. And the question's from Now or Never Books, and the question is, why are all your best characters such fascists? And he names Oswald Bastable, Von Beck, Colonel Pyatt, when you are on the left.
It's a simple one, know your enemy. I mean, I'm not the first author to be fascinated by the reasons why fascists are fascists. So it's a way of examining fascism and trying to understand why people have those attitudes, because the more you know about those attitudes, the more you can resist them, as it were.
Yes, which brings us, of course, back to the whole thesis of your New Worlds tenure, which is to write politically and socially aware stuff rather than machinery.
Yeah.
How do you think New Worlds affected what one might call the mainstream? Do you see bits of its influence now in literary fiction?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it was the mainstream that we were aiming at. I.e., we didn't feel at that time that that modern fiction was really delivering what it could deliver. We were certainly part of a movement. It's very hard to know whether your enthusiasm was helped something get going or not. What these things do is just inspire people. They don't influence people. But they think, oh, good, it's being published, therefore I can write it. I think that's a simple answer.
Do you see stuff now that you think, oh, that might not have happened without us?
I don't think I'm that much of an egomaniac. I think we were part of a movement which certainly did create, the current literary scene, I think without any doubt. I think you can tell that by the fact that a lot of very different writers with extremely different styles and subject matter, who are not considered to be science fiction writers at all, were great enthusiasts for New Worlds. So, I suppose we must have had some sort of influence, but how big it was, I don't know. I mean, we happened to be there at the right time.
Michael Moorcock there, talking to Claire Armistead. At the beginning of the programme, we heard Alistair Reynolds reading an extract from his latest book, Blue Remembered Earth. A scientist by trade, Reynolds specialises in hard science fiction, set in the far future, and recently signed a £1 million book deal for his next 10 books. Alistair joins me in the studio now alongside Damien Walter and Jeff Noon. Writing from the opposite end of the SF spectrum, Jeff's speculative fiction has won him comparisons with the likes of Lewis Carroll and George Louis Borges. He won the Arthur C. Clarke Award for his debut novel, Vert, in 1994, and sets most of his stories in an alternative version of his native city of Manchester. Hi, everyone.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. And Alistair, I wanted to start by asking you about what you've been up to recently. Your new book is called Blue Remembered Earth, and it's out this month. And I wondered if perhaps you might be able to tell us a little bit about where it takes us.
It's basically, I went to the Kennedy Space Center a few years ago, and I really got sort of a renewed burst of enthusiasm about space flight, and I wanted to write about where we were going in the future, about going back to the moon and going to Mars and on into the solar system. And that's basically what the book's about. It's about the sort of next 150 years of sort of human history, but told from a slightly, I suppose, African perspective. The idea is that by the 22nd century, Africa is the sort of the big sort of powerhouse in terms of the Earth's sort of economy.
That aspect of it really interesting, actually, because as he said, it's future, but it's not really far future. It's kind of medium future. And one of the things that interested me about it was the way in which your universe reflects back on where we are now. And so, as well as all the technological side of things, we have things like the three major states appear to be China, India, and Africa, and the US and Europe just aren't in the picture at all, which is slightly alarming, but probably quite plausible.
Yeah, that was a very conscious decision not to sort of make too much of America and Europe.
Yeah.
I mean, that's been done to death in science fiction anyway, and even to some extent, sort of Chinese-dominated future has been done, if you like. So it was just an attempt to sort of shift the emphasis a little bit somewhere else.
The idea of a solar system in which most people speak Swahili,
Yeah, well, I've been listening to lots of sort of world music, and that was what basically kicked me off, was just listening to lots of particularly music from Mali, which is not where the book is set, actually, but that was where it sort of all started from.
And again, it's space opera of a sort, but it's kind of a domestic space opera, isn't it? Because we're talking about our near satellites, the Moon and Mars. It reminded me in that way, actually, of M. Kim Stanley Robinson's Mars trilogy a little bit, the first push.
I'd love that. I mean, to me, that's like the greatest compliment, you know, because I think the Mars trilogy is wonderful. It is very much more grounded in what we might be able to achieve in the next, you know, few centuries compared to some of my other stuff, which is a lot more way out and speculative.
Mm.
And, it's probably the most near future thing I've written in terms of, the sort of references to sort of projections from current day politics into the future and things like that. Didn't just make it all up, basically.
And Jeff, if Alistair does sort of medium future, you really are near future, aren't you? That's the area that you're interested in.
I try to get as close to now as I can and then mutate that in some way to, turn it in myself and exaggerate it a little bit, pick up on certain elements of today's society and have fun with them, push them to the limits and see what happens.
And the last time that you had a book published, that was actually 2002, wasn't it? What have you been doing?
Please. Okay. I've been trying to break into screenwriting, film, the film business, which is a difficult thing to do, and I really dedicated myself to that. And then about a year ago, I got an idea for a novel, which I haven't really had an idea for a novel for a long time, so I thought, oh, this is interesting, so I started to write that, and now I'm back, basically.
So this new book, this new idea that you've had, can you tell us about it?
I could tell you about it. This is probably the first time I've really talked about it in any major way. It's about a woman who turns into a television, and she starts to pick up signals on her skin. She's a pop singer, and by the end of the book, she's more or less covered in all these hundreds of different broadcasts.
Yeah.
That are coming in from around the world. It takes place in more or less one day and one night. It's a real kind of journey of what happens to her and how she survives in that night. And everybody wants her, of course. Everybody's after her. They all want to put stuff onto her. So it's been me really talking about that whole celebrity thing and about the broken signals of digital culture and how we're all immersed in that.
And you've been doing a lot of stuff online, haven't you? This seems to be in the last, since sort of the beginning of 2011.
Yeah, I decided to have a go at Twitter and kind of with baby steps at first, but I've really started to get into it. And I decided that I would really concentrate on content more than anything else in terms of putting fiction up there, whether longer stories like I invented a world called Sparkle Town, which I can use to create slightly longer stories, and then just doing these little, what I call micro spores, which are, you know, your standard 140 character stories or images that I try to create. A little bit of atmosphere, poetry or something for people.
Can you give us any examples of your...
My little stories. Spores. Yeah, sometimes I do things like asleep in their beds, hidden from sunlight. All the vampires dream of finding the last known vial of Lady Diana's blood. So that's almost like a little novel to me. It's like you can imagine someone writing a novel about vampires searching for celebrity blood, you know. But it's 140 characters. It's kind of like... And then I do like love stories. Lonely Variant 259 wishes to meet a Variant 170 for cross-mutation intermingling. We'll also consider Variants 45 or 601 if GSOH.
It's like the LRB in 500 years' time, isn't it? Yes. And Damien, you interviewed Lauren, as we've just heard on the programme. She was talking a lot about Twitter, wasn't she, and about the importance of, I suppose, the online community for science fiction writers.
Well, I think Twitter has become the leading edge of where the science fiction community is. One of the things about being a science fiction community is that we tend to be quite good with technology. So,
throughout the
history of the internet, and you've seen science fiction writers and fans setting up websites and using bulletin boards and chat rooms. But Twitter has really liberated kind of something new in the SF community. And I think lots of writers have discovered their readership and a much more direct relationship with people. It's like a number of other niche areas of culture. At least you think they're niche until you find that actually hundreds of thousands of people really, really love science fiction, but they've never quite been able to find each other.
Yeah.
But social media makes it very easy to go and find that community of readers and writers.
And so we've just heard from Michael Moorcock, and again, he was talking about the idea of the 60s and the new wave and his view that science fiction hasn't really changed a lot since then. Do you think that's true? Is that fair? Or have we actually moved on since then?
To a degree. I mean, it's certainly true that in the 60s, on both sides of the Atlantic, science fiction was sort of invigorated with a sort of injection of quality writing, I suppose, and the willingness to disregard taboos and, you know, to write about sex and to think about structure and form in a way that hadn't really been the case before, although there was lots of valid science fiction written earlier than the 60s. But there have been a number of sort of micro-revolutions in science fiction since then. And I think a lot of the books that have picked up a lot of attention in recent years in science fiction are perhaps not what the old guard would necessarily point to and say that is science fiction.
Okay.
I mean, like a book like Zoo City, which has picked up a lot of acclaim in the last year, and it is a really good book. But it kind of stretches the definition of science fiction, I think, in an interesting way.
Let's talk a little bit about the definition then, because we've just spoken to you, Jeff, and you, Alistair, about what you're doing now, and they're very different things, and they're, you know, sort of far future space opera, that's one thing, hard science, and then near future domestic, urban, speculative,
just making up science that doesn't exist. Yeah.
Do you feel like you're writing within the same genre? And Damien, do you think, as a reader of them both, what do you think?
I think science fiction, which has come to mean a whole range of very different things, everything from Tolkien and magic rings and dragons right through to traditional space rockets and spaceships. And it's sometimes described as kind of a literature of ideas. It's, you know, a way of thinking about what's happening and what's changing in the world. And we live in such changing times at the moment that I think new writers of science fiction are having to find very different metaphors to explore that.
I feel that we're part of the same exploration of change, I think, is really good. I think, and I think science fiction allows you to do that, whether it's on another planet in the far future or, you know, in the cities that we live in now.
Alistair, what about you? Because your work is closest to, I guess, what we originally probably would have called SF. Does it bother you that you've got...
It's got robots and spaceships in it, basically.
Yeah. Do you mind being lumped in with the fantasy crowd?
No, I mean, I think I've always pointed to what I write and said it's basically sort of centre-core SF. It's what, you know, it's kind of part of a tradition that goes back, you know, at least as far back as Asimov, back, you know, back to the 1940s. I mean, hopefully I've added, you know, a few sort of modernist touches to it since then, but it is unambiguously science fiction. It's set in what I perceive as a plausible future. We can get from here to there, whereas, you know, we can't get to a future in which, say, wizards have real magical powers. And that's, to me, that's quite an important distinction. But it doesn't in any way, you know, as a reader, I'm far more of an omnivore than I am as a writer. I mean, I really enjoy reading these books that sort of straddle genre boundaries, like, you know, like China Mieville's work or in Lauren Bucas's work. I think to some extent that's where the really interesting stuff is happening now. And then you've got writers who are sort of operating in on the sort of literary side of the divide, if you like David Mitchell and Colson Whitehead, who are just sort of doing interesting things that sort of spill over into science fiction and fantasy occasionally.
We've seen that more and more, haven't we? Yeah, that spillage over into the mainstream, yeah.
And Damien, I know that you and I have had conversations before about why you have never seen an SF book, well, never officially seen an SF book win the Booker. What do you think? Do you think there's any scope for the mainstream literary culture?
I think there is an extent to which science fiction is a slightly subversive and radical literature as well, and something about, for instance, China Mieville's writing, where China's continually taking on very radical ideas and weaving massive science fiction metaphors around them. And that isn't always necessarily suited for the more middle ground territory of something like the Booker. But what I think is a very interesting discussion is where literature and science fiction do meet, which is at the more kind of avant-garde end of the spectrum. And I think that's being more and more acknowledged. I think there's more and more influence of science fiction within academic departments, more teachers there. It's being taught within more curriculums. Mm-hmm. And I think that's because it's genuinely of a lot of worth and a lot of interest to people in that way.
And hopefully that's going to be something that continues in 2012 as well. And I guess, you know, from this conversation, it seems as if we're all fairly optimistic about where science fiction is going over the next few years. Would you like to just maybe leave us with some recommendations of the science fiction books we should be thinking about reading this year? Damien, do you want to?
Sure. I mean, there's some really interesting titles coming up in the year to come. One by one of the great masters of science fiction, William Gibson, with Distrust That Particular Flavour, which is the first collection of his non-fiction writing. And he's such an influential figure both in science fiction and popular culture more broadly that I think that's going to be a very notable publication. There's also, of course, Rail Sea by China Mieville, so Embassy Town was probably one of the stories of the Booker this year, was why wasn't Embassy Town nominated on there. And personally, I'm also really looking forward to Empire State by Adam Christopher, who's a debut author this year. But it's a book coming out from Angry Robot Books, who have worked very closely with Lauren Bukes, yes. You know. And they found many of the most interesting authors of the last 2 years. So I think Empire State, Adam Christopher, may be one of the titles to watch in the year to come.
Alistair, what about you?
Well, I'm looking forward to, we mentioned Kim Stanley Robinson earlier, and he's got a book coming out called 2312. Definitely my cup of tea, I think. He's a very good writer, and again, he's someone who has had sort of mainstream attention in terms of his writing. I'm looking forward to seeing what Lauren Bucas does next. I think it's going to be even more of a step away from sort of Centre Core science fiction and Zoo City. And when there's just so much good stuff out there, where do you start? Science fiction is in really good health at the moment, I think.
Jeff?
Well, I have to admit that I've been out of it for a while, so I'm just getting back into it. So I'm bringing a really fresh eye on it. I really like Zoo City, which I've just started. It was described, I think, by one reviewer as me crossed with Raymond Chandler, which is good. And I can kind of see that, you know. That's the kind of thing that I love. Mm. Yeah. So yeah, anything that she does in future. But as I say, I'm really just starting out at the moment, again to rediscover what's happened, and you know, it's a vibrant scene.
It does feel like that at the minute. Well, it does. Well, thanks so much to all of you for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Alistair Reynolds' Blue Remembered Earth is out on the 19th of January, and you can read Jeff's Sparkletown tweets at temp_user9, and that's the number 9 rather than written out. And that's all from us today. Here's what's coming up across the papers and the site in the very near future. In the Guardian Review on Saturday, we have a look ahead to what's coming up in the books world in 2012. Gillian Darley discusses the place of new towns in literature, and Emma Brox profiles the American author and critic Edmund White. In The Observer on Sunday, Nick Cohen reviews Thomas Frank's brilliant deconstruction of the Republican surge in the wake of the economic crisis, Pity the Billionaire. Olivia Lang reviews Hemingway's Boat, which is a biography of the author's later years, and Edmund Gordon reviews Tessa Hadley's new short story collection, Married Love. And on the website, as well as the usual news and comment, we'll continue our series of Writers' Desktops with Louise Doughty, give you full coverage of the announcement of the Man Asian Literary Prize shortlist on Tuesday, and scare your socks off with a quiz on horror in children's literature in time for Friday the 13th. That's all for this week. Thanks to Lauren Bucas, Michael Moorcock, Alistair Reynolds and Jeff Noon, to Damien Walter and Claire Armitstead, and to our producer, Simon Barnard. I'm Sarah Crown. Goodbye.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.